the audit that was done on the Department of Human Services and the Pharmaceutical Purchasing Program. You will remember that this is something that we put into statutes. Well, some of you may not remember that we put this in statute in 2001. We did some additional things with it in 2003, and subsequently the Audits Division has done an audit on this program, and so they're here to sort of give us a good look at it. I want to thank the Audits Division, number one, for being here, number two, for sort of giving us the opportunity to take first crack at it. So, with that, Kathy, let me go ahead and call you up, and whoever else you want to have come with you, and maybe what you could do is go ahead and just kind of go through the audit a little bit in terms of, you know, who suggested that you do it and why you did it and kind of the scope and methodologies and, you know, just all the general stuff.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chair, committee members, for the record, I'm Kathy Polino with the Secretary of State Audits Division. Next to me is Sandy Hilton. She's one of our audit managers that supervised this particular audit. And then also a great resource for us here, Allison Knight is with the Department of Human Services and actually knows the program details that you might have some questions about. And so I appreciate her being here to kind of help us through this today. What we'd like to do is to talk to you about our report. It's report number 2005-08, titled Department of Human Services Medicaid Fee-for-Service Prescription Drug Cost Savings Analysis is the title of the report. This is one of our performance audit reports. Over the last few years, we've been trying to focus our performance audit resources on costs that we could focus in on cost savings, cost recovery, or ways that the state can better use the assets that we have. And so this particular audit is one that came up during, as we were kind of looking at a risk assessment statewide of what are some potential issues for us to look at. Prescription drugs and the rising cost of prescription drugs is one that I think is on the forefront of a lot of people's minds. And then any costs associated with the Oregon Health Plan are really important to us at the Audits Division. So this was something that kind of naturally drew our attention as we started to look at where we wanted to put our performance audit resources for this last year. This issue in particular was of interest to us. As we started to do a little bit of research on the topic, we were finding that there were some possible cost containment strategies that are out there that other states are employing to help control the cost of prescription drugs for their Medicaid clients. And so there were some things that they were doing that we weren't doing here in Oregon. And what we wanted to do as far as an audit is provide some information to all of you policymakers on what is the real cost of not implementing those policy decisions. There was some very, very detailed and laborious audit work that went into this particular report. We got some detailed cost information on what we in Oregon are paying for our prescription drugs, various multitudes of different kinds of drugs. And then what are those costs that other states have been able to purchase those same drugs for? And then what are they doing differently than us to get those costs that are, in many cases, lower than what we're paying here in Oregon? And I'm going to turn it over to Sandy to talk about the details of the audit, but I just wanted to give you kind of just a high-level concept of what this cost containment strategy is what we're looking at doing is for certain kinds of prescription drug needs, there is some evidence-based research that has shown what is the best and most effective drugs to treat certain kinds of things, like an anti-inflammatory drug. There's actual tests that have gone on to tell you that this is the most effective drug for that. Within that, once you find the few drugs that are the most effective, what we want to do is try to shift prescription patterns to get those most effective drugs that are also the least cost. So, you know, again, the concept is first making sure we have the most effective drugs to treat certain things, and then second, to make sure that once we have a group of drugs that are the same effectiveness, let's make sure we're prescribing first the least cost so that we can get the most for our limited prescription drug resources. So the concept here is we're trying to get a shift in prescription patterns to those most effective and least cost drugs. And then you'll see in here that there are a lot of safeguards built in because there isn't a formula you can use specifically for what's the best treatment for every patient in every circumstance. So, but the concept is for us as a state, if we're providing prescription drugs to our Medicaid clients in this fee-for-service program, we want to make sure that we're getting the drugs prescribed to them, you know, as much as we can, those least cost and most effective drugs. So that's kind of the concept behind this, and I think Sandy can explain it a lot better than I can, so I'm going to turn it over to her.
Sandy, I just need you to make sure you state your name for the record.
I will do that. Thank you, Chair Crumble. Chair Crumble, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sandra Hilton, and I'm an audit manager with Secretary of State's Audits Division. As Kathy was saying, we're going to be recapping this audit for you, some of our key results from this. It's been a really very interesting audit, this Department of Human Services Medicaid fee-for-service prescription drug costs. As Kathy was saying, the purpose really of this audit was to determine whether there were opportunities that exist to reduce the cost of Oregon's Medicaid fee-for-service prescription drugs. After we finished our audit, we did find that there are actually opportunities that do exist to reduce the cost of these prescription drugs, and that is mainly centers around by requiring prior authorization for drugs not on the state's planned drug list, and by adding some mental health drugs to the list. And however, though, before I get into what the cost numbers were that we came up with, I would like to share with you a little bit of the background information that went into this, too, that might help put more context to it.
Please do.
The Office of Medical Assistant Programs administers the Medicaid program here in Oregon, and it provides health care services to about 368,000 low-income Oregonians. The budgeted cost of the program is approximately $3.4 billion for the 2003-2005 biennium, with approximately $1.3 billion, or roughly 38%, coming from the state's general fund. Services are delivered in one of two ways for this program. It either comes through the managed care plan or for the fee-for-service program. The focus of our audit was on the fee-for-service program, which serves about 30% of the Medicaid clients. The budgeted cost for these services for the 2003-2005 biennium is approximately $1.3 billion in total funds, and that would be total federal and state general fund monies. Of this amount, $512 million was budgeted for prescription drug payments. During the period included in our analysis, which was a 15-month period between January 1, 2003 through March 31, 2004, nearly 50% of the prescription drug costs were for all of the mental health drugs for clients enrolled in either the managed care plans or the fee-for-service program. With regards to mental health drugs, those are carved out of the managed care plans, and all of them were paid through the fee-for-service program, which was the focus of our analysis. The state uses a planned drug list for the fee-for-service program, which really resulted from some legislation that was passed during the 2001 legislative session. The prescription drugs included on the planned drug list are, as Kathy was saying, first they're selected based on effectiveness first, and then cost is considered. But the benchmark drug is first selected on effectiveness. The department implemented the first planned drug list in August of 2002. Within 2 months, the department had four therapeutic drug classes on the list. These four therapeutic drug classes were the only classes of drugs on the list until May 2003. Thus, when we did our analysis, our first cost analysis, we focused in on these four classes of drugs. And the reason for that is that we wanted to make sure that we had a consistent drugs that were consistently used for the entire period of our review. Also, these drugs actually accounted for approximately 8% of the all fee-for-service prescription drug costs during that 15-month review. The 2001 legislation, which actually established the planned drug list, excluded mental health drugs from the list. Since mental health drugs are such a large percent of the total prescription drug spending, and other states, we found during our research, are also adding mental health drugs to their preferred drug list in an effort to further reduce costs, We ended up performing a second analysis for three predominant classes of the mental health drugs. And two of the classes in the mental health drugs were antidepressant classes, and one was atypical antipsychotic drugs. For the second analysis, because Oregon doesn't have a planned drug list that would cover mental health drugs, we did, through our research, we found that West Virginia has a Medicaid preferred drug list for mental health drugs, and that it is similar to Oregon's in that it is based first, the drugs that are selected on the list are based first on effectiveness and cost, and it goes through an evidence-based process similar to what we do here in Oregon as well. The West Virginia, another reason that the West Virginia drug list we found was pretty good is that it gave quite a number of drugs on within the drug list for practitioners to be able to select from. So rather than limiting, you know, one or two drugs, there actually were 12 different for the two classes of antidepressant drugs. There were actually 12 different preferred drugs for that. So that way they do have more choices. As Kathy stated, both of our analysis focused on really increasing that utilization of preferred drug list. And one of the biggest keys that we found was that prior authorization can do that. We also learned that really prior authorization requirements are used by private healthcare organizations, the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, and each of the managed care organizations that provide the health care services to the remaining 70% of the Oregon's Medicaid clients enrolled in the Oregon Health Plan also have prior authorization requirements. We also learned that as of September 2003, more than 30 states had implemented or in the process of implementing legislation that requires a Medicaid preferred drug list. As part of our audit, we contacted several of the states to confirm that preferred drug lists that have prior authorization requirements are actually cost-effective containment tools. What we found is that state Medicaid officials reported to us that there really was a significant savings that had resulted from implementing preferred drug lists that had prior authorization requirements. And I'd like to share with you an example of two states, Washington and Michigan, on that. For example, Washington reported a $12 million savings during fiscal year 2003. Michigan reported a savings of $32 million in 2003. Our research, therefore, suggested to us that really Oregon, too, could benefit from the use of preferred drug lists of prior authorization requirements. And what we found that is, in fact, the Department of Human Services did implement a prior authorization requirement for their planned drug list in May of 2003. And if I could turn your attention to the graph on page 4 of the report for a minute. If you see down at the bottom of page 4, the graph there, that the utilization of the planned drug list increased after implementation of a prior authorization requirement in May of 2003. And actually, it increased to a high of the 85% during that third quarter. However, what happened is in September of 2003, there was some additional legislation that was passed which prohibited the use of prior authorization requirements. And as you can see on the graph, there's then become a significant decline in the utilization of the planned drug list, the preferred drugs on the planned drug list at the Department of Human Services. In addition to the preferred drug list for non-mental health drugs, we also learned that several states have added or are in the process of adding mental health drugs such as antidepressants and antipsychotics to their preferred drug list in an effort to further reduce costs. One thing that we learned in our
Representative Butler?
As soon as I know where we're going here with this graph, Sandra.
Mm-hmm.
So you're graphing out a year, a little bit longer. Anyway, you're graphing out a year here, and you're telling us that that during this year, the legislature passed some legislation to deal with some other classes of drugs being used for antipsychotic and other emotional issues.
Chair Kremel, Representative Butler, this was dealing with a different legislation. The first legislation that had occurred that created the drug list actually did exclude mental health drugs and some other classes of drugs.
I want you to know that I was the 31st vote on that Senate bill on the House side to pass it. And so I'm kind of invested in this, but tell me again what this drug plan list, utilization of four original therapeutic classes by quarter, is.
Okay.
And I need to know your take on that hump.
Okay. Chair Kremel, Representative Butler, this was the utilization of the drugs after the department implemented a prior authorization requirement, and it was a soft prior authorization requirement, I believe, and Allison can fill you in on more of the details on this, but what my understanding is that the practitioner really only needed to call a number and get a recording before prescribing a drug. Is that correct, Allison?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, that is correct.
For the record.
For the record, my name is Allison Knight. I'm with the Office of Medical Assistance Programs, and I'm the Assistant Manager for Program and Policy. And it is correct that there was a soft prior authorization implemented beginning May 2003. And this soft prior authorization basically just asked that if you want to prescribe a drug that's not on the planned drug list, that the prescriber would call in and just listen to an educational message about the drugs that are on the planned drug list. And that is what resulted in this utilization pattern that you see here.
I'm anxious, though, Sandra. The conclusion you've come to is that then after the prior authorization for the call-in, after that requirement is passed, then the utilization of this series of drugs drops off.
Yes.
Did you do this for multiple years?
No, sir. Representative Kremel.
Let me follow up one more question. Are you aware of the trends relative to mental health issues during a certain time of the year? And did you take that into consideration? I mean, during winter and Christmas time and the holidays? Is any of that? I mean, that's what the graph is showing me.
Okay. Maybe I could clear that up,
okay,
Representative
please.
Butler. Chair Kremel, Representative Butler, this did not include mental health drugs.
Oh, okay.
This was the four therapeutic, original therapeutic drug classes when mental health drugs were excluded.
Okay.
What this actually shows us, though, is we looked at the utilization of those preferred drugs on the list, and it went up after the soft prior authorization requirement was put into place. But then once the legislation was passed that did not allow that, Department of Human Resources quit having a prior authorization requirement, and what we saw was a shift going the other direction.
Okay.
And that's what this graph shows us.
Let me ask you this before I go to Representative Brown, and that is the Senate bill that was originally passed in 2001 actually did not authorize any kind of requirement for pre-authorization. So why is it that the department, and Allison, you're going to have to answer this, why is it that the department chose to sort of without legislative approval go ahead and given the comments that had been made on the floor, particularly of the House, where I'm most familiar, why was it that the department went ahead and moved forward with creating a prior authorization, even though you're calling it a soft prior authorization?
Mr. Chair, the way the legislation read was there was some, that the department saw some flexibility in that legislation to allow the soft educational message prior authorization. That is the way we looked at that legislation was that it would allow some mechanism for educating physicians and, you know, increasing the utilization of the planned drug list.
Wouldn't you agree that probably the reason, listening to the debate that occurred on the floor and the comments that were made and understanding legislative intent, wouldn't you agree that that's what led to the passage of House Bill 3624 in the 03 session, was the fact that the department was obviously ignoring what the legislation really gave you approvals to do?
Mr. Chair, I was looking for Barney, our administrator.
Barney seems to have stepped out.
Yeah.
Maybe he was
I'll have to thank
some,
him for that.
He was coming.
In hindsight, I think, from the 2003 session, certainly was made clear. What the department looked at the time in 2003 is that we were faced with a fiscal crisis in the department. And as my understanding of the original intent around the legislation was that the hope for the planned drug list would be that with education we would get a high utilization of the planned drug list, and unfortunately what we saw was that did not happen. And so what we're looking at is ways to increase education to providers so that the drug list would be utilized in the way that was expected with the original legislation.
Now let me just give you a little tip. As a provider, or as a former provider, and understanding how providers think, if I have to make a phone call and listen to some stupid recorded message before I can prescribe a drug that's not on the list, I'll take the path of least resistance and prescribe the drug that's on the list and say screw it, because it's not important to me enough to spend the time to do that. And especially if I'm a provider that's seeing 50 patients a day, and 10 of them, even 10 of them coming in, and even if the message is only 3 minutes, that's 30 minutes that I've just taken out of my day. Actually, it's probably more like 4 or 5 minutes per patient. And if I've got 10 of them, that's an hour. I don't have an hour if I'm seeing 50 patients in a day. And I'm not going to screw around with it. So what I'll do is I'll take the path of least resistance, and I'll just go ahead and prescribe the damn drug that is on the list and not fight it. Okay. Representative Brown?
I thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that you may have answered some of my questions, but my memory is not as good as the rest of my colleagues, and I don't remember all these bills and what they did each time, and I'm sure I probably voted on them at the time, but I couldn't recall how I voted. But at the 85% level there, you say that changed and started to decline because of the prior authorization was removed by legislation, or the requirement for prior. And so that's what drove that figure down then.
Chair Crummell, Representative Brown, I don't know that you can totally say with certainty, but that definitely was a factor. It was the only thing that we could find that was a big major change.
And
there is a correlation
between driving that figure down, and it also increased our costs then, because
yes,
they were not utilizing this planned drug list then.
Yes, sir.
Okay. All right. I think I'm clear now.
Okay. Go ahead and continue.
All righty. Thank you. Also, too, that getting back to the mental health drugs, if we could focus for a moment on that, too, that one of the things that we found during our audit was that one of the main concerns was client access to all of the available drugs, and especially the mental health drugs. And so what we did learn is we asked some questions about this when we did talk to other states who had implemented this, and what we did learn is that there are a number of safeguards that are being used to protect Medicaid clients. And on page 2, we have listed not all of them, but we did give you a sample of some of the safeguards at the bottom. If you see the bulleted items,
mm-hmm.
and the safeguards to protect mental health clients. For example, some of the safeguards that we found were that they'll put more than, they'll try to get a number of drugs on the preferred drug list, similar to West Virginia's that would have 12 antidepressant drugs. They wanted to make sure that they had enough of that. They also had grandfather clauses that would allow, if you had patients that were stabilized on certain non-preferred drugs, to remain on those drugs. There's quite a few comprehensive exception policies, especially for mental health drugs, so that if the client needs that, the client can have that drug.
Does the provider have to call in first?
Chair Crummell, yes. The providers would be calling in first. Most of them. Well, they have different ways of handling that.
Okay.
Different ways. There's a number of ways, but this is something that states have wrestled with, is to be able to still provide that access and cut costs at the same time. So, and these are some of the mechanisms that they're using to do that. If we could move on to the results of our audit here, I'd like to explain to you what we found. We found that in looking at, in both of our analysis combined, the four therapeutic drug classes, which represented about 8% of the costs, and also our second analysis, which included mental health drugs, not all mental health drugs, but some mental health drugs, which represented about 41% of the costs at the time. We found that for that 15-month period, we analyzed that if the prescription patterns had increased, which I'll get into those details in a second, to what level, that the state could have saved approximately $11.7 million in totals, general state funds and federal funds. Using some cost data that the department had provided for us for that same period of time, that's about enough funds, that's enough savings to pay for all the medical costs of about 2,600 Medicaid clients, to put some perspective into how much that number could buy there. I'd like to share with you though some of the specific results of our analysis. For the original four therapeutic drug classes, we identified that the state could have achieved about $2.3 million in total fund savings if the state had achieved about a 90% utilization rate on its planned drug list. During the 15 months that we analyzed, the department paid approximately $18.5 million in total funds after all required Medicaid rebates for about 330,000 prescriptions in these four drug classes. If the utilization had been increased to 90%, there would have been a cost savings, it would have cost approximately $16.2 million for those same drugs.
Let me have you back up for just a second, Sandra. What at that $18.5 million and for over 330,000 prescriptions that were actually written in those four drug classes, what rate of utilization is that of the PDL?
Chair Kremel, I don't have the actual utilization rate. How we did our analysis is we brought the utilization rate up to, we had all of these drug claims. There was a whole lot of them, and then we had to start funneling them down. We had to funnel them down to the drug classes that we analyzed, and then we further funneled them down to the preferred and the non-preferred. What we ended up doing is we, at that point of our analysis, we found an average cost for a preferred drug list. And we actually did a comparison. We looked at the actual cost of the mental health drugs. We looked at using this average
of the mental health drugs or the non-mental
drug classes. Okay. We did it the same way for both of them, though.
Right.
So we came up with an amount, the actual amount, and then using the average cost, we calculated if the state had achieved a 90% utilization rate for these four therapeutic drug classes, what the cost would be, and then we looked at the difference.
Okay. What I'm having a hard time with is this, and forgive me, but I, because I wasn't a math whiz in high school or college or any other level for that matter, but if you don't know the utilization rate on the above at 18.5 million, then how can you make the statement, a definitive statement, that at 90% utilization you would save $2.3 million? If this is 60% utilization or 40% utilization, then you've got it. Then now you've got something that you're actually comparing to. But if you're saying that this is a, we don't know what the utilization rate is here, but we know that we could save $2 million by going to 90%. So help me out here.
Okay, Chair Kremel, we do have. If you look at Appendix A, to clarify this. Because we do actually have the utilization. I apologize, I wasn't quite understanding where your question was coming on this. But if you look at for each of the classes, like the long-acting opioids,
uh-huh.
I always have trouble with that one. There is...
That's all right, so do I.
63% of the total claims was on the preferred drugs at 51% of the total cost. And then you can see the breakdown for the non-preferred. Is that the information that you were after?
So now, if you were then, so based on that, if you were then saying 90% of the total claims, what are you projecting then would be the percentage of the cost? And what would you, so what you're, because what you're showing me in Appendix A then, is you're saying that 63% is the utilization. And if you add 27% more to that, then the actual cost would have only been 16 million or 16 point whatever it is million, and that it would have been, but the other so adding 27% to that, it would have dropped the cost down. And so there would have been $2.3 million in savings. That's what you're telling me. So what percentage of the total cost would that have been?
Mr. Carroll, maybe if I could, what we have in the report on page 5, it talks about that the total cost was reduced for those four classes by 12.4%. So I don't think we went through and we can easily go through and look at the reshaping of the pie. But we found if we can shift that prescribing pattern over to those preferred drugs, the total cost of the drugs would go down by 12.4%.
Okay.
Reduction. And I think one of the things, while we have the appendix open, we were talking about the preferred versus non-preferred drugs,
mm-hmm.
And that, you know, preferred drugs, generally speaking, are less expensive, but there are some cases where they ended up actually being more expensive. And I think you can see that if you look at Appendix B in the mental health drugs, there is
the one antidepressant.
The antidepressants. Mm-hmm. You'll see that the preferred drug list is actually more expensive. But again, going back to that evidence-based, is you know they were more effective. They're a little bit more expensive too. And so, again, I just want to make sure that concept of the evidence showing that these are the most effective drugs being that number one driver is the most important. But overall, the costs for those preferred drugs, when you take them in total, are less expensive than the non-preferred drugs.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, just out of curiosity, what were the number of scripts written on the preferred drug list?
Mr.
I guess, well, I guess
you see that first column, total drug claims?
I guess 225,000, huh?
It's that's down at the
that's right.
Right, for the preferred.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, go ahead.
Alrighty. That was really useful. Thank you, Kathy. It helps to explain more of this appendix, too. All righty. Okay. Also, too, our audit, one other thing, and we can refer back to this Appendix A, too, and this might be a good thing to point out, too, was that we found that on the average for these four drug classes, as we've been talking about, you can tell that the preferred drugs and the difference between the non-preferred drugs and the preferred drugs are actually generally less expensive than the preferred drugs. And for the non-preferred drugs are actually usually significantly higher than the preferred drugs in cost. So when you look at the very back of the report down at the bottom where it says summary of the four drug classes, if you look at the total number of claims and the percent of the total cost, you can see while the non-preferred drugs were about 32% of the claims, there really was about 47% of the costs that were related to those non-preferred drugs.
Where are you at again?
Down at the very bottom.
Oh, okay.
Of the, it's a summary of four
Got
classes.
It.
It's over here in the far corner there.
Yes. Okay, thank you.
So that kind of shows you that proportional difference that we saw. There was quite a bit of difference.
Okay.
Our analysis also found that the department could have saved approximately $9.4 million in total funds for that same 15-month period had antidepressant and atypical class, antipsychotic class drugs been added to the planned drug list in a form similar to the West Virginia's approach. And like I explained before, we did use, and the reasons why we use that West Virginia drug lessons, Oregon doesn't have one, and it appeared to us that that would be a good one to use. What we did as far as the utilization rates for that one, we took a little different approach. We figured a 90% utilization for both classes of the antidepressants and an 85% utilization for the atypical antipsychotic drugs. And we did that because our research indicated that the utilization rates, that these were obtainable rates, and in fact, if anything, they're a little on the conservative side. Some states told us they actually did better than that, but we certainly didn't want to overpromise on what we thought could be attainable, so we took a little conservative approach on that.
Now, let me ask you this. You chose West Virginia because they have an evidence-based preferred drug list as well. And in the private sector, we know that drug costs are probably a little different than they are, depending on who the insurance carrier is and whether the insurance carrier has a formulary or preferred drug list versus an insurance carrier that doesn't. For the poor schmucks that are paying full freight on the drugs, is the cost of the drug in West Virginia the same as it is in Oregon? In other words, let me just take a drug like Prozac, because everybody knows what Prozac is and what Prozac does, and it's a mental health drug. Is the cost of a 30-day supply of Prozac the same in West Virginia for the schmuck that's paying full freight as it is in Oregon? Or is there a price difference? And if there's a price difference, why is there a price difference? Is it because of economics in the two states are different? Or is it because a drug company likes West Virginia better than they like Oregon? Or they like Oregon better than they like West Virginia? Or is it because, you know, so what are the reasonings there?
Okay. Chair Crummell, I don't have that information for you exactly what the difference is. I will tell you, though, that we did try to find out.
That you asked?
Sir, what we did try to find out, let me talk to the in-charge for a minute. Was that discussion on in the interviews? Do you remember?
No, because that's the proprietary
information. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh, the old proprietary information thing.
And
it's called price fix.
Chair Crummell, we entered into this. We had a problem, really, when we wanted to identify supplemental rebates. And the reason we don't have a dollar number in our report, because there's additional cost savings here that could have been had, and it would have been from supplemental rebates. Because if we had been, you know, if we had had a drug list of a prior authorization requirement, some drug manufacturers, what we've been told, will enter into supplemental, you know, will give better prices on supplemental rebates if their drug is put on the drug list, mm-hmm. preferred drug list. What we found, though, is we couldn't get that information by any particular drug or manufacturer because it was considered proprietary. Thank
by
you.
By both the manufacturer as well as the insurance carriers?
Well, we checked with other states is who we were checking with, and we couldn't get that information. What we did get, though, and I do have it here that I can discuss with you. In fact, I can move right over to that. Is we were able to get a couple of examples, though, of what the total supplemental rebate savings in total was for two of the states that we talked to. They wouldn't give us the details by specific drugs, but in total we got that information. And, for example, in Washington, the Medicaid officials reported to us that they had an additional savings of over $1 million just from October 2002 through March of 2004 from supplemental rebates. And Michigan told us that they actually received an additional $8 million in 2003 from supplemental rebates. So you're correct, sir, that that can be very different, the cost of drugs for states. But it's very hard for us to get that kind of information.
Okay. Okay. And did you talk about the pool already? Let me stop and you go ahead. Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you. All righty. I had talked a little bit about that difference in the utilization rates, the 90% for the antidepressants and the 85% for the atypical antipsychotics. Also, too, moving on, continuing on with the mental health drugs, that during that 15-month that we analyzed, the department paid for approximately 1 million prescriptions of antidepressant and atypical antipsychotic therapeutic class drugs. And the total cost of those prescriptions after any Medicaid rebates was approximately $91 million in total funds. The drug classes analyzed accounted for about 41% of all the fee-for-service prescription drug costs during that period. And we figured if these utilization rates would have been met, the total cost could have been reduced to approximately $81.6 million in total funds. And also, too, in looking at Appendix B, we kind of looked at Appendix 1, but Appendix B, we did the same thing for the mental health drugs as what we did for the four therapeutic drug classes.
Did you say Appendix C?
B, sir. I'm sorry.
Thank you, because I thought I was losing my mind. I couldn't find Appendix C.
You're fine.
Okay.
I didn't enunciate quite right there.
What you said and what I heard, somehow it was different, but that's okay.
Alrighty. At the very bottom, you'll notice, too, at the very bottom of the page over here on the far right-hand corner, again, the utilization, even though the non-preferred drugs for all these classes was about 29% of the claims, that the total cost was about 42%. And that includes for all of them. And then, as in the other appendix, we broke it down by the three drug classes so that you can get a better look at how that varies by drug class.
To get your average cost per claim, are you simply taking the number of claims and dividing it into the total cost? I mean, is that sort of just a linear equation there? I just want to make sure that I'm reading it right. If that's what it is.
Yes, Chair Kremel, it is a weighted average in that. That is how we calculated it. Yes, sir.
Okay. I think the answer to my question was yes.
I'm not sure what your question was, even when you start talking about linear equations.
What I mean is that you take 53,213,667, divide it by 806,355, and you come up with $65.99 per claim. Is that that's a linear equation? If you go straight across the line,
straight
across, it's a linear.
I'm with you. I think Representative Rosenbaum, who once accused me of thinking too linear and too linear a fashion, as I recall.
I'm doing the math correct there, right?
You're doing the math correct, sir.
Okay.
Alrighty. Okay. We've talked a little bit about this. I kind of skipped around a little bit. In addition to these direct savings, we did have that supplemental rebate savings that we already discussed, too, but we couldn't put a number to it.
And you mentioned in the supplemental rebate part of the audit, Sandy, that the second column there about halfway down, it says, but without prior authorization requirements in place, Oregon cannot join a purchasing pool. Is that because of pool requirements that we can't join a pool?
You know,
they won't let us play in their pool?
Chair Kremel, I think I will defer this one to Allison. I think she is better in a better position to explain that. We had some questions about that as well.
Okay.
And I think she could probably do a better job explaining that.
Mr. Chair, the department has been very interested in joining such a purchasing pool, and we have met with one of the pharmacy benefits management companies that is doing one of those drug purchasing pools, but without prior authorization to drive utilization to those preferred drugs, there really is no incentive to have these states participating in the pool. So really, to participate, you need to have some mechanism that drives utilization to those preferred agents.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Brown?
Yeah. Would there be any additional savings by purchasing these drugs out of Canada, or can they be acquired there?
Chair Kremel, Representative Brown, that's not something that we looked at in our analysis.
I can tell you, though, that the Prime Minister, or not the Prime Minister, the Minister of Health and whatever it's called in Canada, spoke at a conference that I was at last November, and very eloquently said, and I quote, "Canada will not be the drugstore for the United States." So, if we're thinking that we're going to go to Canada and buy the drugs cheaper, we have another thing coming.
I think the state of Illinois did that, though.
Well, and they're probably going to get shut down at the border because Canada is not going to allow it to happen. So it'll start driving their costs up.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Brown.
Hi, Butler. Thank you. I guess my concern then is there any indication of some economies of scale of buying in mass and trying to accumulate a warehouse of U.S. side drugs? Was that examined in that process? Some economies of scale.
Chair Crummell, Representative Butler, that's not the angle that we took on this particular audit.
I guess, Mr. Chair, I'm a little bit anxious about that because certainly if we're just trying to go between the preferred drugs and the non-preferred drugs, if the preferred drugs were offered at a better price, to say that these issues are not price-driven is basically the conclusion that you came to, and I don't know that I would come to that. I mean, the whole discussion about Canadian drugs is 100% about price. It is not about formularies. It's not about preferred versus non-preferred. It's about price.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, if you've come to the conclusion that it was only about preferred and non-preferred, then, I mean, you probably made it to the top of the ladder. It was just leaning on the wrong wall.
Okay. Chair Crummell, Representative Butler, I can. One thing that we found, though, is and that the by being on a preferred drug list, though, that does offer better cost. You know, it's more incentive for drug companies to negotiate price. And so.
I won't dispute that, Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, if I could, you know, if I were. Glasgow, Klein, Smith, Beecham, and whoever else happens to be part of that group, and I could put my, my number one drug that I'm wanting to sell is my new invention on the market, and it can get on a preferred drug list. And I know that the number of scripts that are going to be written for it are going to go through the ceiling. Of course, I'm incentivized to bring the price down a little bit.
Mr. Chair, you've hit right ahead on that supplemental rebate.
Mm-hmm.
Issue is, you know, that there is a little bit more negotiating power to be able to get those companies to provide supplemental rebates when you do have a required preferred drug list.
Have you ever figured out that buying drugs is kind of like buying a car?
Mr. Chair, while Kathy is speaking, I just would like, Kathy, the direction I'm coming at is a little bit different here, and that is that if we're going to go ahead and study this, and I didn't realize this was within the venue or the purview of the Secretary of State's Audit Division to do this, but my recollection is that there's been some rather substantial studies done within the Department of Human Resources and perhaps over in the Office of Medical Assistance Programs, there's been some studies. I assume that you were able to go in and that the amount of time and energy that was placed in this particular audit was driven by information that was probably already had been prepared, and you just mined the data that was available?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, and maybe Allison, correct me if I'm wrong, my understanding is that there's been studies on kind of the theory of the issues, but actually the details of what the cost savings could be hasn't been done yet, and that's where our audit kind of came in and took. We mined through masses and masses of data to get to this point so that we could provide information on, as close as we can get our hands on, what the actual cost component is to that decision. So, you know, the issue's been studied, and I think a lot of people agree that there's some merit there, but we didn't know what this was actually costing us to decide not to have a preferred drug list, a mandatory preferred drug list, versus having one. And so this really is that first piece of information that was actually based on what the tangible cost savings potentially could be.
Mr. Chair, if I could just follow up on that, then Kathy, in like manner, I guess we could send your office over to the Department of Administrative Service and ask them if they're if they're making the same kinds of intelligent choices with regard to the purchase of automobiles or the gasoline cards and those kinds of things. Have you considered expanding the scope of these? This is obviously more than audit. This is Management Advisory Service now. I mean, you've got a whole bunch of accountants over there that are working on this. I guess my concern is twofold in that regard. First of all, it's the authority to do what we're doing. The second is that if I've got folks over in the Office of Medical Policy and Programs that I'm paying, I don't know, a much lesser fee than I would be paying for a certified public accountant to come and do this, wouldn't that be a better utilization of our resources that we have those folks do the... And it sounds like that you did have them do the majority of the work up for you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, there's about a bunch of really good questions in there. I hope I can cover them. Maybe getting back to the why us and why we even got here, if we think back about, the constitutional authority of our office and why we're here, it all stems on that concept of fiscal accountability and making sure that public programs are being carried out both legally, that the funds are being used as intended, and that we're getting the most for those funds. And it goes back over time, looking back at, again, to those territorial statutes that talks about, the duties of the office look at being the auditors of frugality and making sure the economy and efficiency in public office. And so what we're hoping to do and what kind of led us here is that there was a program that has the potential to be carried out as effective, if not more effective, at a lower cost. And that, again, drove us to this area is that there was a lack of information on what this particular program was costing and again, the details of where that cost information, the impact of this decision was kind of a lacking piece of information out there. And so, we heard the concept being thrown around. We saw what has happened over time in this particular area. But we also found that there wasn't good information out there on what the impact of that decision was, what it was costing us. So going back to one of the concepts of the audits and the role it plays in state government, and one of the keys that it does play is providing information to decision makers so that they can make policy decisions. We don't make policy decisions, and of course that's something that we do, but our office serves a role in providing independently gathered information and facts so that you can make policy decisions with information behind it. And so really that was the thrust of what we were trying to accomplish here is to get all of you good information on this issue independently gathered so that you can weigh the pros and cons of the policy decisions.
But you did make a policy recommendation.
Mr. Chair, what our recommendation, again, is to have all of you consider this information in light of that policy decision.
Well, recommendation number one says allows the addition of antidepressant antipsychotic class drugs to the PDA, to the planned drug list. Number two says requires prior authorization of medically appropriate or necessary drugs not on the planned drug list. And those are both policy recommendations.
And again, we'll get into semantics on the wording, but we do recommend that they introduce legislation so that this can be discussed.
One of the questions, or one of the things that you mentioned, Kathy, was that it's legally being done. And I brought up the issue earlier about when Senate Bill 819 was originally passed and the language that was in there relative to requirement of prior authorization. So, did your auditors find that the department was acting legally and within the parameters of the bill and of the law when they went ahead and instituted a prior authorization requirement without legislative approval?
Legislation.
Because one of the things that you said is that those statutes are to make sure that they're followed legally.
Chair Kremel, we from the, our review of the legislation and looking at it, we didn't see that there was anything explicitly stated that prohibited the prior authorization requirement. Yeah, until the bill was passed. Mm-hmm. Until the other bill was passed. This was before.
Right,
the,
right.
This was before the bill that
right, no,
prohibited
I understand.
It.
I understand. I'm, yeah, yeah. I'm talking about before House Bill 3624 mm-hmm. was passed. Mm-hmm.
In the initial bill, we didn't see anything in there that explicitly prohibited them from doing the prior authorization.
Did you see anything in there that explicitly permitted them to do prior authorization?
Representative Crumble, no.
Did you go back and look clear. At legislative intent? And is that part of your review when you're reviewing whether or not an agency is acting legally within their bounds?
This, Chair Crummell, the scope of our audit here, the focus of our audit really wasn't on whether or not that particular prior authorization was appropriate or not. You know, that's just not the focus of our audit. It was to see if there was some cost savings that could be made, and we centered around the cost objective. Of course, if we would have noted that when we reviewed the legislation, that the department had acted inappropriately and it had explicitly said they shouldn't have done this, and then they did it, that would have been in our audit report.
Okay. Look around before I... was there anything else that you wanted to present before we...
You know, I think we covered it. I think we ended up covering it.
Okay.
There is one other thing I did want to bring up, though, to Chair Crummell, members of the committee, is the other matters in this, too, that our audit report, we wanted to note that effective January 1st, 2006, the Medicaid clients eligible for both Medicaid and Medicare will receive that prescription drug coverage primarily through the new federal Medicare Prescription Drug Act. Mm-hmm. What we learned during our audit is we couldn't attach numbers to this. We didn't have the exact amount where we could tell you how much this would impact the savings for sure, but the department estimated and told us that they thought approximately 50,000 of the Medicaid clients served by both the managed care plan and the fee-for-service program would shift to the new federal program. So at the time of our audit and completing our audit, we didn't have dollar amounts to attach to that. So we just wanted to make sure you had that information as well.
Yeah, that's commonly referred to, members, as the clawback provision of Part D Medicare prescription drug program. And I'm suggesting that the reason why it's called the clawback provision is because the feds are going to come clawing back here wanting more money. But yes, that is absolutely true, and there is going to be some trade-off relative to the prescription drugs and how that all fits together. And we probably will be sending money back to the feds after they send it to us. Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I apologize because I was out of the room for part of your testimony. If you already answered this, but is there any other category of drugs that are excluded other than mental health drugs that you've been talking about?
Yes, Chair Crummell, Representative Rosenbaum, there are several other drugs that have been excluded. I don't have them all on the top of my head right now, but there are things such as the HIV drugs and cancer, certain mm-hmm. cancer drugs, and maybe Allison could give you more of an update of what's in here.
I think that's the three that are currently excluded right mm-hmm. now. I believe that's...
Okay. Yeah. And just a
follow-up
question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are these, do you know if these programs that we have in place are parallel to what most private sector plans are doing right now in terms of formularies or preferred drug lists?
I can answer part of that. Chair Crummell, Representative Rosenbaum, one thing that we did find is that the prior authorization, having a preferred drug list with a prior authorization requirement is something that is commonly done. We found that for the managed care side of this, there's 70% of the clients are actually served through managed care, and for them, there actually is a prior authorization requirement. We also found the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs and private health care organizations are in that direction, as well as more and more states are now going that direction.
Mm-hmm. Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But what I was really asking is, are these exclusions parallel to what most private plans are doing, or are these mental health drugs included in their provisions?
Mm-hmm. Maybe. Do you have that information, Allison? I don't have that particular information.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, I haven't looked specifically at what other private insurance companies are, as far as mental health drugs, have on their preferred drug list, so I can't really answer that question. I know that a number of private health plans do have mental health drugs on their drug list. It's just that, you know, whether or not that would coincide with the drugs that were reviewed under this audit, I don't have an answer for you on that. So
I see Barney starting to come forward. And mm-hmm. Barney, if you want to pull up a chair and...
I'll just try to add some. Mm-hmm. For the record, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Barney Spade, Office of Medical Assistance Programs. Representative Rosenbaum, I can speak just generally from my background that in private sector commercial coverages, it's very typical to use a formulary preferred drug list for antidepressants. I can't speak definitively about antipsychotics, mm-hmm. But most commercial plans, whether they be managed care or PPO, the Oregon PEB, the new Medicare programs for Part D, et cetera, will all generally use some form of preferred drug list or formulary.
Great.
And I think it's more common with the antidepressants, but I can probably get some information back to you relative to antipsychotics.
I appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Other questions?
I was going to ask the same one that Representative Rosenbaum asked. So
okay.
Great minds think alike.
There you go. One of the questions that I have is that it says in the report, and you mentioned that the focus of this was the fee-for-service side, Sandy, but it also says in here, that nearly 50% of prescription drug costs between January 1, 2003 and March 31, 2004 were for all mental health drugs for clients enrolled in either managed care plans or fee-for-service. And then later in the report, it refers to the fact that, 50% of the costs on fee-for-service it's on page 3, is the third column over, and it says, for the time period of our review, mental health drugs accounted for nearly 50% of fee-for-service prescription drug expenditures. Now, and earlier you said it was for both. So my question is it, if you look at only the managed care side, about 50% of the drug costs are for mental health drugs, and only for fee-for-service side, about 50% of the expenditures are for mental health drugs, or is that a mistake? I mean, because you kind of said that it's both, and then you said that it's just one.
Chair Krummel, Allison can probably give you more of a better program explanation for this, but the clients who are served under the managed care plans, their prescription cost, though, for mental health drugs comes under the fee-for-service program. So maybe you could provide some additional clarification on that.
Well, yeah, Mr. Chair, Sandy is correct in that. Because we have the mental health drug carve-out for the managed care clients, those drugs are not covered by the managed care plans. They're covered under the fee-for-service program. So those drugs are considered a fee-for-service drug. So 50% of the cost of all fee-for-service drugs, including mental health drugs, which include clients that are enrolled in managed care as well as fee-for-service, half of that fee-for-service drug budget is spent on mental health drugs.
But didn't you testify earlier that mental health drugs are not covered under fee-for-service? If there's a carve-out, so you're actually skewing the results then, because you've got one area where the drugs are covered, managed care, another area that they aren't covered, fee-for-service, but the benefit is actually paid out of the fee-for-service side for the managed care side to get their mental health drugs. Am I hearing that correct?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. I mean, mental health drugs on the fee-for-service side are certainly a disproportionate share of the, if you looked at the total drug budget, including managed care and fee-for-service, mental health drugs in total would be a smaller share of that total drug budget. But because we're only looking at the fee-for-service drug budget, which includes, which has that mental health drug carve-out, mental health drugs are disproportionately represented in that fee-for-service drug budget. So we are paying a lot of fee-for-service costs on mental health drugs.
So why wouldn't you pay the mental health drugs out of the side that they're actually covered on, i.e. managed care, as opposed to paying them out of the fee-for-service and actually skewing the fee-for-service and probably lowering the amount of money that's available for fee-for-service?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Barney Spate,
out here,
Oregon Office of Medical Assistance Programs. Let me see if I can help describe a complex situation. In our contracts with the managed care organizations for physical health and for mental health drugs are not included in our payment rate to them. They're not financially responsible for them, nor are they responsible for any of the management of those prescriptions. Those costs are borne on the fee-for-service side. The reason that we do not include any of the mental health drugs in any of the payment arrangements we have with managed care is that we, by statute, are precluded from doing that.
Okay.
Therefore, they default to fee-for-service management, and in that default to fee-for-service management by our program, we basically, I think the report is trying to indicate we have limited tools. We do academic detailing and drug utilization review and things like that, but we don't have the same array of tools that some other states have.
Barney, do you know off the top of your head, and I know you don't have the statutes right there in front of you, but do you know off the top of your head what statute that's in that precludes managed care from being able to pay for the mental health?
I believe, I can't give you the reference, but I believe it is the statute that's been informally referenced here in that cancer drugs, HIV drugs, and mental health drugs, that there can be no limitation placed on those, and in our contractual relationships with both physical health contractors and mental health contractors, we permit them to use control mechanisms relative to utilization. So that would be, I'll verify if I'm incorrect on that. I'll get back to you and verify that.
Okay. Thank you. Some other questions that I have is that did the audits division look at whether or not drug utilization was driving costs in other areas such as hospital visits, need for surgical care, or need for surgical intervention, reductions in other types of therapies that might be attained, reduced office visits to providers, looking at the whole array of physician care, because one of the arguments that's always made is that, well, yeah, drug costs are going up, but everything else is going down. So did the division look at that?
Chair Krummel, no, that was not within the scope of this audit. This audit did focus on prescription drugs. And this audit, though, is not indicating that there should be a change in a different usage as far as using drugs, that people shouldn't be using prescription drugs. It's just a change in the utilization of which ones they use for their particular condition.
Okay. Go ahead, Alice.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, if I could comment on that, because that question does get asked a lot, and it is a good question. And like Sandy mentioned, that as far as we're not looking at moving clients away from using a drug at all, but the fact that these drugs have been through the evidence-based, the independently researched evidence-based review process, that does show, okay, out of this whole class of drugs, we've looked at these top four drugs do appear to be the most effective, or there's no difference in effectiveness. So that really informs our decision, because we choose those drugs based on what has been determined first as being most effective. And so I would be surprised if it had a downstream impact on other, you know, on other areas of service, because these drugs really do show themselves to be the most effective in the class.
So you would be surprised if they did have a downstream effect? So you're saying that utilizing various drug therapies do not tend to drive hospital costs down, do not tend to drive office visit numbers down, do not tend to drive other therapies down, do not tend, so we're not saving one damn dime on other stuff that we do in healthcare?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I guess if I could just clarify on this, I was just trying to talk about the substitution of different agents within the class. You know, obviously, you know, we think that, you know, drugs within the class, you know, do perform, you know, effectively in helping offset other, you know, hospitalizations and things like that. It's just that for the drugs within the class, for those preferred agents, you know, those are really reviewed for effectiveness and safety. And so if that utilization increases to those preferred agents, you know, we wouldn't expect a change in some of those other health services, because these drugs, you know, are the most effective in the class.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, again, for the record, Barney Spade, I think, as I understood your question, what it went something like this. Even though rising pharmaceutical costs, I mean, there is a cost for the new technology associated with new pharmaceuticals, are there not offsetting costs in other areas of the health system relative to, in either substituting expensive hospital care, fewer ambulatory care visits, perhaps improved quality of life, et cetera, on an intuitive and anecdotal basis, I would say yes to that. I mean, I don't think anyone can say that the advancements in pharmaceutical management of healthcare over the last decade has not contributed to both improved health and improved quality of life. And for some conditions, I'm not an expert in this, we, I think, clearly know intuitively and anecdotally, and probably there's research that I'm not familiar with, is that many of these drugs are, in fact, delaying, or in some cases, mediating altogether other healthcare resources. The point that I think Allison was making, within a particular class of drugs, the assumption is that probably two drugs, same class of drugs, one's 50% more expensive than the other one. Both of them probably have that same impact, though, on what does it do to the overall healthcare costs. So I believe your question was in fact, I mean, correct in an overall, what's the role that pharmacy costs play in today's healthcare costs, is they clearly are either contributing to improved quality of life, or probably less expensive interventions that would have occurred if the drug regimen hadn't been followed.
Okay, thank you. So we don't know then whether or not the same holds true for or the same would occur for preferred drugs versus non-preferred drugs. In other words, if we use the drugs that are on the preferred drug list, we drive down pharmaceutical costs, but we also have an effect, a downstream effect, of driving down costs in other interventions that potentially are used to treat a medical condition of some sort.
Mr. Chair, let me try to respond by saying this from a general point of view. If a given set of drugs has an impact on course of disease, and that impact prevents hospitalization, fewer visits to the physician, improved quality of life, if there are competing drugs with different prices, and they are similar, or actually, in the case of generics, actually the same, then we'd assume that the impact of that, of those respective drugs, would be the same across the whole cost impact for other healthcare services. So then it gets to the point of, within the relative cost of two drugs that are in the same class, what's the cost for the prescription and overall management of those drugs if there are difference in unit costs and utilization. And I think that's primarily what the Secretary of State's audit has pointed out, is that preferred drug lists do tend to drive utilization to lower cost drugs. And another point of this is the use of generics, and we have a very high generic use rate even in our fee-for-service area. So it's looking more narrowly at just managing the cost within the pharmaceutical domain or silo, with the assumption being that these drugs, particularly this, all of those that are on the PDL, probably make similar contributions to the downstream costs that would have otherwise been incurred. Mm-hmm. I hope that's helpful.
Okay. Did the audits division at all look at the basis for increased drug costs? I mean, is it because of higher utilization, prescription costs being higher, more prescriptions being written for the same number of patients, or because there's higher number of patients? I mean, did you look at any of those sorts of things as you were going through and looking at this?
Chair Crummell, I want to make sure I understand your question there. So are you saying that did we look at for our population, why the... Are you talking about the graph, the 85% graph? Is that...
Well, I guess it would relate to that, because, you know, one of the things that we've been hearing about is that you know, drug costs are going up, and cost of pharmaceuticals, and you know, the cost of for the Oregon Health Plan and for all of the Medicaid services that we provide are all going up, and I was just wondering if that I realize that it wouldn't have been a focus of the audit, but in considering some of the things within the audit, is that something that you looked at to say, well, yeah, we can see this is happening or that is happening?
Okay, Chair Crummell, not precisely. I couldn't tell you what the reasons are why prescription drug costs are going up, but we really focused on is how to get the prescription drug costs down, and with the supplemental rebates and the prior authorization being effective tools to do that. Our research indicated that these costs are increasing substantially. The exact reasons why, you know, they are increasing was not part of our audit. No, we accepted that as a fact that they were, though, based on our research. And our mission in this audit was to see if there's a way to find out how we can contain that better here in Oregon. So, and maybe, probably maybe Barney or Allison might have more information about why drugs have been doing that.
Mr. Chair, if I understand your point of inquiry, let me respond this way. My experience at the Office of Medical Assistance Program, albeit limited, leads me to the following kind of general conclusion. Medicaid programs can generally buy drugs cheaper at the unit on a unit cost basis because we get substantial rebates pursuant to federal law. In a fee-for-service system without a PDL or other kinds of management tools, the utilization of those drugs tends to be higher than they are either with a PDL in fee-for-service or when we compare drug uses, for example, in our managed care contracts, where they're working primarily on both a combination of moving script writing to a lower cost alternative, but also managing with the physician partners that they have contracts with the utilization rate. So I think there's on the managed care side, there's a combination of both effect. Slightly, they don't get the level of discounts we do, but they do a much more better job of managing the utilization patterns, primarily working with physicians to pick the most appropriate drug for the right drug at the right time for the right patient.
Mm-hmm.
And our fee for service program, it's much less structured that way. We do a lot of post prescription drug utilization reviews using the drug utilization board, looking for patterns where we can go out and talk with folks. In the managed care, it's much more prospective. They work with the docs in advance using their formularies and prior authorizations.
Okay. Because in a system like Kaiser, for example, Kaiser Permanente, they pretty much just stock in their pharmacy whatever's on their PDL, and the doctors are pretty much expected to follow that. They have to give a pretty good reason. I know Barney used to work for Kaiser,
yeah.
So you can correct me if I'm wrong, but so the doctors really, or the providers really have to, you know, pretty much use what's there. If they do want to go outside of that, they have to give a pretty doggone good reason why they...
Mr. Chair, let me... I know a little familiarity with Kaiser Permanente. The drug list is really managed cooperatively by the physicians within Permanente and the health plan, and it's kind of their drug list. They can write around the formulary anytime they want, and I think most private sector insurance companies that use a PDL, while they may have prior authorization, they always have an exception based on the nature of the patient, et cetera. So,
right. Well, and as you know, I've been a critic of the evidence-based sorts of things that have been going on, and my biggest criticism is that what it starts doing is pointing us towards cookie-cutter medicine as opposed to real, holistic, individualized medicine. And that's... that's just a fact of life. Or when you're looking at evidence based types of formularies and that sort of thing, that's my biggest criticism.
And I would agree on this point, Mr. Chairman. I think that any formulary, any preferred drug list that first of all is not grounded and accepted by the practitioners that are going to be using that, and then doesn't have a fair and timely exception device, because I think increasingly we know about evidence-based medicine is that there is a lot of more knowledge now about staying within some norm of practice for many works well. There also is, your point is that there are many exceptions outside that norm that need that practitioners are the first that see it, understand it, and can manage it.
Right. Thank you. A couple of other real quick questions here, Sandy. One is the comment was made. Let's see if I can find it. I don't want to hold this up here too long. The comment was made that pharmacies on page 3 in the first column, it says towards the top, it says pharmacies are required to dispense a 72-hour supply of the drug to the client in an emergency situation. This is under the safeguards. And I'm just curious, is that the prescribed or the preferred? Or do you know? Or do we care? Well, we care because of the cost factor, because that's going to lead to the cost issue.
Chair Kremel, I will refer to Allison or Barney on the specifics of this, but the reason we have this in here and why we wanted to point this out is that if it is a non-preferred drug, there has to be a 72-hour supply of the drug given to the client anyway. So that's another safeguard. That's an additional safeguard, a federal law requirement, in addition to some of the other state safeguards that we found. So what we were trying to point out in this section is that, yes, you know, we wanted to address what you're bringing up as some concerns, and that is that there has to be safeguards in place for mm-hmm. clients.
Right.
Absolutely. And our audit wanted to make sure that it pointed out and made a strong point on that, that you wouldn't want to just arbitrarily say everyone has to use these drugs. You want to have some safeguards in there.
But if a provider has prescribed X drug, and the preferred drug list says that it's the Y drug that you use in that particular case, the pharmacy has to fill the script within 72 hours. Which one do they fill if they don't have the authorization? Do they fill the prescribed drug, or do they fill the preferred drug?
Because there's a little bit that laws a little.
Mr. Chair, as it currently works, the client would receive the drug that the prescriber prescribed, and that is something that could be looked at as far as safeguards go, because there are a lot of safeguards that need to be considered, when you implement a preferred drug list with a PA. So that would be one of them that you would look at.
Sandy, under objective scope and methodology, you mentioned that the performed preliminary analysis is in second column. Fee-for-service prescription drug claims and drug rebates using our analysis determined that they were sufficiently reliable for our audit purposes. So are you saying, is this within the 0.05 level of confidence as far as the information that you received?
Okay. What we have done on Chair Crummell, I'm sorry. What we have done here is we have some audit requirements and that we have to follow when we use data. And it depends on, these requirements require, depending upon what we use the data for, what kind of work that we must do in order to satisfy our auditing standards. We were getting our data, this is, we looked at 100% of the data that came from this First Health Services Corporation. And this corporation, we did some analysis. We also, for reasonableness, to see if our data appeared reasonable, we also relied some on two service audit reports that had been prepared on First Health Services Systems of Controls. And so we don't have an, I couldn't tell you that it's 0.05%, but we came around after our initial work that we have done on this saying that we are comfortable that it is reliable and sufficient for the purposes that we used it in our engagements.
Okay. How much did this audit cost?
Kathy, do you have that?
I need you to come up. We'll kick Barney out of there for a minute.
Beyond my ken.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, this audit has just gone out, so we don't have the final bills in, but we will get that for you and get it to the committee as soon as we have it.
I would appreciate that. Let's see. I think I have just about... I'm just checking to see here if there's... How many states did you actually talk to? It says that you talked with several. I mean, several could be, you know, 3, mm-hmm. 17, 49,
you know. Chair Crummell, Sharon, do you have more of an idea of the exact number of states? Because we surveyed, in our survey, we actually tried to get information from even more states, but not everyone responded back to us. I don't know, I have an exact number off the top of my head, but it was a number of states. Wasn't it like 15 or 16 at least?
If you're going to say much more, I need you to come forward and give me your name and stuff, unless Sandy's going to try to reiterate everything that you've just said.
Chair Crummell, she's confirming what my remembrance of this was, that it was around 15 or 16 states. But what we did is we targeted states that you know, from our research that we found that were mentioned in research that had been making strides in these areas. We contacted these states. Some states responded to us. Some states didn't respond to us. So 15 to 16 would be the number that actually gave us some pretty detailed information.
Mr. Chair, could I offer some information?
Sure, please.
With your permission.
Please.
My colleague at the Office of Oregon Health Plan Policy and Research, and I have a piece of paper here that I'll give to staff. I only have one copy. It lists the state Medicaid programs that use preferred drug lists, and I believe there are 28 states that use a preferred drug list, and it's noted with an asterisk that some of these states have restrictions of one form or another on mental health drugs.
Okay.
And I'll make that available to your staff, and then the committee can use that.
Great.
In its deliberation.
Great. Thank you. Let's see. Does anyone else have any questions or comments?
I would guess that the work that Barney did on this is probably going to cost us less than the Secretary of State's office. So.
Most likely. Okay. I don't think I
yeah,
have.
You don't want a CPA to tell you how to make hamburger and to do so cheaply and mass production, nor do you want them to tell you how to run your schools, nor do you want to tell them to have you how you should prescribe medicines. These are areas, and Mr. Chair, this is my last comment for the record relative to the current Medicaid fee-for-service prescription cost savings analysis. I think that this whole presentation and audit from the Secretary of State's office really goes to, pushes to a very close slope that we may not want to continue to go down, and that is how do you select what is going to be next in making recommendations as to policy in the state of Oregon through the Audits Division. And I appreciate the fact that we need to have folks analyze. I don't think it's been any secret what Barney has shared with us today or what Allison Knight has shared with us relative to the fact that certain drugs may cost more, certain drugs may cost less. If you buy more of this in quantity, they may cost you a little less. If you buy less of this in quantity, it may cost you more. I mean, that's last I saw the supply and demand curve, a pretty good summary of what it provides. I guess my concern is that knowing that, I'm not sure that I want accountants to come in and tell us that we think that you can get by using this kind of psychotropic drug, and that you could have saved a whole lot more if you'd have moved over to this psychotropic drug. I'd vastly prefer to have those folks that are very professional continue to make most of those decisions, and I appreciate the fact that Sandra will tell us that we probably could have saved money had we done this. But, you know, I could have been independently wealthy had I invested in another kind of stock rather than putting money into Enron, too. So, I mean, you know, accountants are great at 20/20 hindsight. We really do a great job of being scriveners of history. And I appreciate the fact that you can tell us, hey, we may have made some bum decisions in the past, but, you know, I just am anxious about the Secretary of State's Audit Division getting over into an area that looks more like a policy area, and particularly when we can have this issue that says, basically, I told you so. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
And I do want to commend the folks who put in a lot of time and effort, and I am anxious to find out total cost, as are you, Mr. Chair.
I am. One last question on a piece of paper that I just happened to pick up here as I was sort of cleaning off my desk, and that is, are there any, Allison or Barney, that you're aware of, are there any bills in the hopper to add mental health drugs to the PDL?
Mr. Chair, we are currently working on a legislative concept to do that. The current governor's recommended budget does have savings in the budget for the pharmacy program, and to achieve those savings, because the department has done so many other things at our disposal that we're allowed to do to try to save money in pharmacy costs, so we've kind of exhausted our possibilities to save money in the pharmacy area. And so what we've done is, like I said, in our budget, we do have both the adding mental drugs to the PDL and then allowing prior authorization with safeguards in place for drugs that are on the PDL in order to help us achieve those savings in the pharmacy program. So it's in process right now.
Okay. Well, according to the Senate President, we're going home soon. So, you know, I wouldn't wait too long before I got that concept.
Yeah. Right.
It's just down to you and me, Madam Vice Chair. But I guess we can quit now, can't we? Have we sufficiently gone over this thing, you think?
So.
Okay. I will be looking forward to getting the other information, and I would echo what Representative Butler said with regards to, I was a little bit surprised to see a policy recommendation in the audit report. I'm also a little bit concerned about that, but I will look forward to seeing what the total bill is on this. Thank you very much. With that, I think we will close the informational hearing, and we will stand adjourned.